Hi. First, I want to thank the MSU Library, John Shaw, and Michael Rodriguez for organizing this event. Did a wonderful job. They have asked me to not do my 30-minute tribute to John Cage. I was going to close my laptop and then just sit quietly. You can't do many John Cage jokes around, but this is one room you can. I also want to thank Sandra Seaton. It's wonderful that we can get together every once in a while, and her work kind of brings us all together. So thank her for today. My name is Brian Collins. Today I'm representing the MSU Alumni Association. We have a platform that enables us to showcase all the great things that are happening at MSU. And help the alumni, along with the global audience, tap into their or connect to things that they really care about. And so it's been such a pleasure working with the three presenters today, helping them put together these visual collections. As Etta said in the book, this is one of the, or you're going to see three crazy quilts, and the quilts are going to be dynamic, so they're going to be changing in look and feel, and sometimes you're going to be seeing some of the same pieces reappearing. We'll be revisiting them in different contexts, and as our understanding grows of the different events, they're going to change in color and hue. So this platform that is being used by over 70 groups at MSU enables you to grab content from online and mix it together with content that you upload from your computers. So I've been able to work with the three MSU professors for the past couple of months, and they're very not only serious scholars, but very engaging, and very I've put together some very interesting presentations. Ken Prouty is going to be starting out today. He's an assistant professor of musicology and jazz studies at MSU's College of Music. Like the three of them, the theme that cuts across, very serious scholar books, presentations. You can see his bio and his current research if you go on to the collection, which is available online. So you can see his, where he's got his PhD and some of the courses that he teaches. Ken will be starting out. We'll also hear from Tama Hamilton Ray, and she's an assistant professor at the Residential College of Arts and Humanities at MSU. So if you visit this collection, you'll be able to see that Tama was in the Peace Corps in Kenya and has her PhD from MSU. And you'll see that she's very serious in film. So the visuals are going to pop out of hers and Ken's and Pero's papers. And finally, we have Pero Dagbovi, the associate professor in history. And Pero is, if you visit the collection, you can see some of his scholarship work, a couple of his books. Pero is also has his PhD from MSU. But all these three, you'll see themes that cut across and are interconnected, we'll be examining music history from different perspectives. Pero's going to be looking at it through the civil rights movement. Tama's going to be looking at it through the coming of age, and Ken's going to be looking at it through the music perspective. I'm going to be your DJ today. I'm going to be at the laptop and kind of moving these pieces around and helping you, complementing the stories that the presenters are telling. Thank you, Ken.
Okay. Thank you, Brian. Thank you for plugging the book with the wonderful picture of me that looks just like Herbie Hancock on the front. Just a little bit about the paper before I start. This is an edited version of a paper that was given last year at the annual meeting of the Society for the Study of Midwest Literature, where we all presented. Actually, all three of us have extended versions of these papers that are being reviewed for a special issue of the Journal of the same society. Those will be coming out at some point. The title of the paper is A History of Music in Music History. And as I read through the paper, we will be using some of the clips and images that Brian has put on the site to illustrate some of the things that are going on. Okay, here we go. In her play Music History, Sandra Seton uses music to explore the experiences of Etta Bradshaw, the play's main protagonist, a young African-American student at the University of Illinois in 1963. For Etta, music represents not simply a diverse set of sounds, but a wide world of experiences, which take her beyond her own upbringing, first in Tennessee, then on Chicago's West Side, beyond her sorority house, and beyond her family's expectations. Throughout the play, Seton uses music as a means of reflecting the complexities and contradictions of the worlds of Etta and her contemporaries, including Walter, her jazz pianist slash SNCC activist friend, sisters from her sorority house, her family, and others who drift in and out of her social and cultural sphere. But music is also a character that looms large in the play. Seton is not content to use music as a background element. Instead, her choice of musical characters in the play, ranging from classical composers such as Tchaikovsky and John Cage, to pop singers like Johnny Mathis and Ray Charles, to bluesmen like Muddy Waters, to jazz artists such as Miles Davis, reflects a multidimensional world. If individuals are defined by their choices in music, Etta is a character who largely and intentionally defies definition. Among the myriad genres which frame Etta's experiences is the Western classical tradition. Etta's expressed interest in the music of symphonic stalwart Peter Tchaikovsky and experimentalist John Cage near the beginning of the play is highly significant, as it neatly encapsulates the contested nature of the academic musical canon at the time. As central as the music of the Western tradition was and still is to the Western canon in 1963, the forces of radicalism were having a profound impact on the discourses of musical composition. In one exchange later in the play, Etta recounts to Walter a conversation with a professor in which he tells her that, quote, before you get into Cage, better start with a little Tchaikovsky, start with your foundation and work your way up. Cage was, to put it mildly, an unusual figure in musical discourse, whose work questioned the very definitions of music itself. If we can have the first clip. This is, what?
Oh, hi there. Now may we have our next contestant?
You know what year this
will
is?
Will you come in?
Yeah, this is a, Cage is, it's like What's My Line or some kind of game show.
What's your name and where you're from?
My name is John Cage. I'm from Stony Point, New York.
Mr. Cage, and he is from New York. Now, Mr. Cage is a musician. He is a composer. He teaches a course in music at the New School here in New York. Now, Mr. Cage, if you'll whisper your secret to me, we'll show it to those folks out there, huh? All right. Well, that's pretty interesting. And there must be more.
If you could skip ahead a little bit to about 5 minutes or so in, where he actually is doing his performance. There, somewhere around there.
Oh, he watches his watch as he works. He takes it seriously.
Okay. You can see on the table the different things.
If you are amused, you may laugh. If you like it, you may buy the recording. John Cage and Walter Walsh.
And this goes on at some length. Cage's most famous or infamous work is undoubtedly the work entitled 433, which is typically performed as follows. The performer enters the stage, bows, sits at a piano, opens the lid on the keyboard, and proceeds to sit in complete silence for 4 minutes and 33 seconds. At the end of the work, the performer closes the lid on the keyboard, stands up, and takes a bow, presumably but not necessarily to the audience's applause. Of course, the key point to be made is that the performer does not really sit in silence. Sounds from the audience, the lights, the HVAC system, and other ambient noises comprise the soundscape. And I don't think we need to watch the whole 4 minutes, 4.5 minutes. You get the idea. Apart from the classical tradition, by the early 1960s, jazz was also coming to be regarded as more of an art music, a style for more serious listeners. And as counterpart in the play and co-protagonist, Walter is older, more worldly, a seemingly more serious person, and not coincidentally, a jazz fan and performer. Walter seems to have a particular affinity for the music of Miles Davis, whose work is often described as the epitome of cool, an attribute that is frequently invoked to describe Davis's music through the early 1960s. Indeed, Davis's 1949-1950 Capitol Records sessions were retrospectively titled Birth of the Cool, we happen to be listening to that right now, on their re-release in LP format in the late 1950s, signifying his impact on this particular approach. Davis's coolness, however, was not confined to his music, but also deeply informed his personal interactions. He rarely showed outright anger and was often silent in the face of questioning and criticism, and constructed a public image for himself that sought to deflect rather than confront, sometimes going so far as to play with his back to the audience. This is not to say that Davis was not outspoken on the issue of race relations. He was. But that such engagement was often couched in what I would term an aesthetic of minimalism. By invoking Davis's music, Seton links Walter's experience as a jazz musician with his work as a civil rights activist, and with SNCC in particular. Coolness can also be seen as a significant part of the civil rights struggle, of which Walter was a part. The use of Davis's music, in particular the album Kind of Blue, which we'll come back to in a little bit, points to a resonance between the music and the image of the legendary jazz trumpeter, and the images and strategies of civil rights activists, particularly that of SNCC. Can I get the first pick? And we see here. Davis's penchant for finely tailored suits, which Seton cites in her initial description of Walter at the beginning of the play, resonates with scenes of lunch counter strikers in Greensboro in 1960, young black men dressed in business suits, projecting an image of professionalism and seriousness that belied the way that many Americans, and not just those in the South, saw black men. Davis was not content to play the commonly prescribed role of African-American entertainer. Turning his back on the audience was not simply an act of elitism. It was, in essence, a boycott of their own expectations. Davis's son Gregory spoke to this idea in a book co-written with Les Sussman called Dark Magus, The Jekyll and Hyde Life of Miles Davis. Noting that clothes were one of his favorite things, Gregory Davis suggests that his father was a pioneer in using fashion to establish a black male identity as something more than a caricature. He writes, quote, "I credit my father for being the one to make a dark-skinned black man fashionable. He helped change that image," end quote. In many cases, figures in the civil rights movement, from Martin Luther King Jr. to the sign carriers on the street and the lunch counter protesters at the Greensboro Woolworths in 1960, wore conservative business attire in order to portray a professional image. Such fashion choices were, like those of Davis and other jazz artists, consciously made in order to counter prevailing stereotypes of black identity, to be taken seriously by the public and the press. Derek Katzman discusses this emphasis on appearance among protesters in his account of the staging of a Freedom Ride in 1961, writing that, quote, "Participants were expected to dress neatly at all times. For men, this meant a business suit or sport jacket with a tie. Women would wear skirts or dresses. All participants needed dress clothes for the meetings," end quote. By contrast, Mary Beth Norton points to the ways in which later protesters departed from the earlier model of professional conservative attire, noting that, quote, in direct contrast to earlier nonviolent civil rights protesters who wore suits and ties or dresses to demonstrate their respectability, male Black Panthers dressed in commando gear carried weapons and talked about killing pigs, end quote. And like those later protesters, epitomized by the Black Panthers and groups such as the US Organization, Davis's fashion sense departed from the professional business snoop model by the end of the 1960s as well. At his appearance at the Isle of Wight Festival in 1970, for example, Davis appeared on stage in a red leather jacket and shirt, opened at the chest, revealing several gold chains, accompanied by rhinestone-studded jeans and white shoes. Wish we had that video. It's a great video. Despite these later stylistic developments, Davis's Kind of Blue remains perhaps the single most recognized of Davis's recordings, and it also plays an important role in Seton's play. Recorded in early 1969 and released later the same year, the album is today considered a seminal work in the jazz canon, a perfect example of the intersection of maximal artistic freedom within the context of minimal musical structure. If we could play a little bit of this. And actually, you could bring the volume up on this a bit. Where's the... Where was the other video? Yeah, that's the one. And this is actually not from the album Kind of Blue. This is a live performance that was made right around the same time, but it's the same material. And we see John Coltrane patiently waiting for his solo turn in the background. Okay, that's good. This album is probably best known among jazz fans and critics for its popularization of the modal concept, a compositional and improvisational framework in which traditional chord structures are replaced with static harmonic phrases. Put another way, there are long sections of songs that use a single chord or scale. This is an example of the kind of minimalist approach referred to above, a stripping the music to its essence. One might think that such a structure would make it easier to play, but modal improvisation is in fact a highly advanced concept, as making sense of a single harmonic center requires a sophisticated understanding of harmony and melody. It is, above all, cool in its approach, articulating an aesthetic of restraint and introspection. Davis's evolving approach, which was reaching its zenith during the period of Seton's story, was one that privileged an aesthetic of understatement and even silence. As his groups grew more adventurous, Davis and his collaborators, in fact, played less and less. At the risk of reading too much into this, I suggest that protesters sitting in silence, taking abuse and criticism without provoking the abuser, is itself an act of aesthetic minimalism. This is something that King understood. It is easy to respond to violence with violence, to respond to abuse with abuse. Not responding, on the other hand, is difficult and requires a much more intricate understanding of human nature. We can have the next video.
Well, I don't think of love as, in this context, as emotional bosh. I don't think of it as a weak force. But I think of love as something strong and that organizes itself into powerful direct action. This is what I tried to teach in the struggle in the South, that we are not engaged in a struggle that means we sit down and do nothing. That there's a great deal of difference between non-resistance to evil and non-violent resistance. Non-resistance leaves you in a state of stagnant passivity and deadened complacency, wherein non-violent resistance means that you do resist in a very strong and determined manner. Well, I don't think that's true. If anyone has ever lived with a nonviolent movement in the South, from Montgomery on through the Freedom Rides and through the sit-in movement and the recent Birmingham movement, and see the reactions of many of the extremists and reactionaries in the white community,
He wouldn't say that this movement makes, this philosophy makes him comfortable.
Okay.
I think it arouses...
I sense that Walter, Seton's co-protagonist in the play, understood this philosophy as well. And this may explain his expressed affinity for Miles Davis's music, as well as the man himself. As a young African-American man who is both a jazz musician and a civil rights activist, Walter had the unique ability to see these ideas in action in both worlds. Hilary Lapidus, in an article on the use of popular music in cinema, points to two examples of film narratives that are closely linked, as is music history, to the 1960s, namely The Big Chill and Forrest Gump. With respect to the latter, Lapidus writes that the use of popular song in Forrest Gump goes beyond simply providing a background for the film's narrative genre. Songs such as Creedence Clearwater Revival's Fortunate Son are heard as Gump arrives in a helicopter at his army base in Vietnam. Similarly, Scott McKenzie's San Francisco frames his longtime friend Jenny's experiences in the hippie movement. In these examples, music is not simply in the background. It, and I quote, stands as an image in its own right, end quote. In music history, Sandra Seton likewise uses many different forms of music, selecting works from classical to blues to pop and jazz to effectively provide a sonic and cultural commentary for her story. The seeming bewilderment of Etta at the complexities of coming of age at a large Midwestern university are made manifest by her exposure to and interest in many different forms of music, each with specific ties to various facets of her world. But the music in music history is not simply a backdrop or a soundtrack, as with Forrest Gump. Seton's play utilizes music as a meta-narrator, providing important clues about the world in which its characters live. But in music history, music is a character in its own right, giving voice to the conflicted and contested identities of the times. Thank you. Hey, where are we going? Who's next?
Good afternoon. Thank you. Thank you. Unlike Ken's presentation, my use of technology is not as coordinated. So I'm just going to deliver my paper, and I've given Brian the liberty to just put stuff up on the screen when it is relevant. I'm very pleased to be participating on this panel on Sandra Seton's music history. I've known the Setons for some time now that might date me a bit. We've been neighbors in the Bailey community in East Lansing for about 15 years. Several weeks ago, while writing an article manuscript on music history, I had the pleasure of interviewing Sandra about her life as a playwright and about this play in particular. Also, her husband, MSU English professor James Seton, offered me valuable hands-on feedback and meticulous edits on my essay that made me feel like a graduate student again. But I greatly appreciate the feedback. It wasn't critical, it was very, very helpful. I respect them as scholars, but also, as we like to say, good people who value family in contemporary and in historical context. That is a theme that comes out in Seton's plays often. Now, onto my paper. This presentation is a very condensed version of the previously mentioned article manuscript that I recently submitted along with my colleagues to Midwestern Miscellany to be considered for publication. The original title of my essay is, quote, "A Glimpse of African-American Life, : History, Civil Rights Activism, Love, Coming of Age, and Racial Terrorism in Sandra Seton's Music History." Today, I've entitled my talk, "Reflections on Sandra Seton's Music History, a Theatrical Return to an Imaginative Understanding of the Civil Rights Movement." As a professionally trained historian, I appreciate the successful dramatization of Black history. That is, plays and films that serve as effectual points of departure for exploring and problematizing the ambiguities of African American historical landscape. We really don't know what happened in the past. We're doing our best to reconstruct it. Therefore, plays offer us an ability to look into history. Plays are indispensable utensils in the historian's toolbox. According to Harry J. Elam, Jr., August Wilson is the key practitioner of this theatrical return to the African-American past. Elam writes, quote, "Wilson's plays focus on the experiences and daily lives of ordinary black people with particular historical circumstances, end quote. Wilson situated his plays at critical junctures in African American history and explored how his characters' personal stories are inextricably linked to the history of the African American struggle. These type of themes are very relevant while considering Seton's plays, especially music history. Between 1989 and the 1990s, up until the president, Sandra Seton has authored 10 plays with African historical subject matter. Her first debut play was in the 90s, Bridge Party. It's a lynching drama. The play takes place in 1942, and she references the early years of the Great Depression through World War II, including a key reference to a 1933 lynching of an individual by the name of Cordy Cheek in Maury County, Tennessee. In the years since her debut play, Seton has explored other epochs and significant subject matter in African American history, including Reconstruction, Civil War, the relationship between Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, and everyday life of African-American students during the modern civil rights movement. That is the focus of music history. Further, in more than a few of her plays, her characters' memories of the past emphasize the value of thinking historically. Seton has remarked that her sense of history can be traced back to her early years. Quote, I knew about my family history from the time I was a little girl, Seton reminisces. Later, I majored in English, but I almost had enough credits for history major. I loved history, end quote. While composing her historical dramas, Seton regularly engages in fundamental historical research. For example, when she was writing music history, she drew upon the prolific civil rights movement historian Charles Payne, who has authored a whole host of important books on the civil rights movement. Music history can be analyzed from many different vantage points, as the papers today demonstrate. As a historian, I am most interested in how this play can provide a window into African-American life, especially during a pivotal year of the civil rights movement, that being 1963. In addition to exposing us to the life of a studious and committed 24-year-old student nonviolent coordinating committee activist with Walter, and the independence, cultural curiosity, intelligence, and understandable naivete of 19-year-old Etta Bradshaw, in music history, Seton successfully delves into numerous important overarching themes in African-American history and culture during an apex of post-World War II civil rights activism. Many of which, as is the case with the plays of August Wilson, reverberate into the present. Among these complex topics and issues are non-dysfunctional black love, generational conflicts, notion of respectability for young black women, the intricacies of black sorority and fraternity culture, Du Bois's notion of double consciousness, the development of African Americans' social consciousness during the 60s, the ambiguous nature of black authenticity, social responsibility, racial profiling, de facto segregation, anti-black violence. We could go on and on. I'm not going to bore you with trying to deal with all of those. I'm going to focus on a few things. Seton subtly and directly historicizes the experiences of her characters, especially Etta and Walter, and provides introspective insights into history's meaning at personal and broader levels. As was read today, Rise and Shine as 1963, Etta clearly lets her audience know that it's 1963 directly. On top of that, Etta declares, March 7th, 1963, newsflash, Freedom Riders board the bus down south. We know very clearly that the play is set in 1963, not only by the description of the play, but throughout the play. The fact that this play takes place in 1963 is very, very important. This was a pivotal year in the black freedom struggle, and the roll call of events during this year is never ending. And we can just have some of them flashed up on the screen. It marks the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. Governor Wallace utters his infamous segregation now, tomorrow, and forever. James Baldwin publishes The Fire the Next Time. Martin Luther King Jr. begins sit-ins and major protests in Birmingham, Alabama, and writes his letter from the Birmingham jail. You have a whole host of sit-ins throughout southern cities. You have Birmingham having their segregation policies declared unconstitutional. Medgar Evers is murdered outside of his home in 63. James Meredith becomes the first African American to graduate from Old Miss. Martin Luther King delivers his famous August 28, 1963, I Have a Dream oration. Four little girls are murdered in Birmingham, Alabama in a church. The list goes on and on of important events that take place in 63. What I want to talk about is just a few of those different types of things. The first thing that we learn about is activism. And as one of the scenes that was read today so wonderfully demonstrated, we see the whole notion of the violence that Walter encounters when he is down in Mississippi, when he is in Greenwood. We had a reading that demonstrated this, that a bomb was thrown at them while they were organizing. It was probably this activist nature and maturity and change the world mentality, not to mention his Miles Davis demeanor, that Etta loves. Like Miles Davis, Walter's main man, Walter possesses a defiant swagger and is not afraid to be himself. Etta is also defiant. She makes bold decisions, challenges familiar traditions, attempts to challenge de facto segregation, grapples with what it means to be black, and even exhibits an eclectic sense of style and fashion. It's important to note that Etta is 19 years old and Walter is 24. Etta most likely reveres him because he represents something new, atypical, and unpredictable, and an inciting alternative to life in Pi Lambda that Etta is encountering. They also share a common worldview. They're both critical thinkers, confrontational, intelligent, and avid readers and music lovers. Etta transforms throughout the play. Perhaps her first major influence away from home is Walter. In a quest for self-discovery, she strives to emulate Walter in many ways. She learns from his activist experiences and not too distant personal history. She also learns through her own personal experiences. She's a rebel. She disregards the dress code of her sorority for an important historic event for Pi Lambda and then decides to move out of the sorority home and drop out of the organization. And she is a legacy, this should be pointed out. Not only this, but she decides to change her major to music history against the wishes of her mother. With these decisions, she goes not only against familiar traditions, but against black cultural historical traditions. And African-American women majoring in anything related to history at this time is definitely very forward-thinking and advanced. Etta decides and attempts to move off of campus. More than a few of the advertisements for the vacant apartments that she reads emphasize whites only. Etta's sorority sisters, as well as an elder NAACP member, warn her of the dangers of challenging the limits of segregation. One of her sorority sisters, Feezy, jokes, Etta's a test. When Etta and her pledge sisters go out looking for a place in Champaign-Urbana, they are blatantly denied because of the color line. Doors are shut in their face, they're yelled at, they're dehumanized. Seton's portrayal of race relations in Champaign-Urbana in the early 60s is consistent with the historical record. I actually went and did some so-called fact-checking and found some articles about what it was like to be black in the 1960s in Champaign-Urbana, and there was a lot of segregation. There were clear gender divisions during the civil rights movement as well, and almost every quote that I wanted to read was read today, so you don't have to have me try and read it better than it was read. I won't even try to do that. But you remember the reading about the notion of going down south when Etta wanted to go down south, and she challenges Walter, basically as a budding feminist, challenging the notion that women should be behind their men, you know, doing the small type of tasks. Etta was not willing to do that, and this is an important theme during the civil rights movement because a lot of the scholarship demonstrates that women were often asked to operate behind the scenes. Etta's clearly not willing to do that. Another historical theme that I found interesting was this notion of the reversed Great Migration. And this is subtle. Maybe people saw the play or read the play and didn't catch this, but I thought it was quite intriguing. There's this reverse Great Migration, if you will, where African Americans who had moved to the North go back to the South to maintain their cultural and familiar traditions. Frank shares with Walter how much he loved to return to the South with his uncle Pack, also known as Pack and Go. And this term Pack and Go is used, it's derived from Uncle Pack, to talk about the process of picking up and going down south in a quick manner. This is Frank speaking. When I was little, I couldn't wait to go for summer to come so I could go down south. Uncle Pack Up and Go, that's what we used to call him. My Uncle Pack would come and get me, Pack Up and Go. We wouldn't leave till about 9 at night. Never would drive in the daytime. He put my suitcase in his truck. On the way down, he'd always stop for gas. First, he'd ask to use the restroom. If they said no, he'd look them right in the eye, bold-like, point to the hose, say, pull it out, and we'd drive off. That is Frank, one of Walter's fraternity brothers, providing some recollections of how he was socialized by his uncle, who clearly taught his nephew not to accept second-class citizenship. And from African-American history, we know that the culture of resistance that characterizes black history is oftentimes passed on from generation to generation. Those militant Nat Turner-like folk in people's families tend to produce others like them. Now, Walter's return to the South. Armed with his training in political science and copies of the Mississippi Constitution, Walter returns to Mississippi in 1963 to help register folks to vote with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Founded in 1960 as a byproduct of a series of student events spearheaded by Ella Baker in Raleigh, North Carolina, SNCC soon developed into a grassroots organization with many supporters in the North who helped them raise funds to support their work in the South. Many young college-educated freedom fighters actively work with SNCC on projects in the South. They were known for their grassroots fieldwork and radical brand of politics. SNCC played a crucial role in the sit-ins, freedom rides, voter registration drives, marches, anything you name it. In his autobiography, former SNCC member Cleveland Sellers observed the following, quote, "It was the only action-oriented civil rights organization in the South prepared to absorb the brash young militants who joined the movement because of the rides. Despite the trumped-up prosecutions, the long jail sentences, the brutal beatings, and the constant threat of death, SNCC organizers refused to be run out of Mississippi," end quote. Walter is clearly one of these young, brash militants that Cleveland Sellers talks about. Seton also sheds light on the outlandish voting tests that the people were forced to take, and we heard a reading about that with counting the numbers of seeds in a watermelon. This type of unconstitutional trickery was common during the Jim Crow segregation era in the 1960s, and as late as the 1970s, and it has its roots going back to the post-Reconstruction period when African-American men were the first to be allowed to vote. In 1964, for the record, only 2 million of the South's 5 million voting age blacks were officially registered. This is in 1964, a year after the notion of this play took place. I want to conclude with a discussion of what I call the theme of anti-black violence or racial terrorism that I think is a theme that pops out in Sandra Seton's play very well and in other ones. Anti-black violence was a defining feature of the civil rights movement. White resistance to integration and blacks' demand for social justice was regularly manifested in blatant, overt, and savage violence against African Americans. According to one of my friends, who is a SNCC historian, Hassan Kwame Jeffries, quote, "Acts of racial terrorism were acceptable to both state and federal officials because their participation gave the impression of order and legality. Violence, of course, was the key to maintaining racial hierarchy," end quote. In Act 2, Scene 4, Walter goes down south suddenly without informing Etta, who is hurt as a result of this, especially since Etta implored him, her first, not to return to Mississippi. They talk over the phone, and Walter discourages her from entertaining the idea of coming to Greenwood, Mississippi. And you heard the discussion that was read once again that Walter and Etta have. And she, and Walter talks about this beating and attempted rape that a black woman faced while she was in prison. Well, this resonates with the real case that took place and many others. Activist Fannie Lou Hamer, for example, on June 9, 1963, was returning from Charleston, South Carolina with other activists from a literacy workshop in Mississippi. The group was arrested and imprisoned on false charges. Behind bars, Fannie Lou Hamer, as well as some of her other fellow female activists, were beaten viciously. Fannie Lou Hamer reminisced that this was the most horrifying experience in her life, and that not a day went by that she didn't think of this horrific beating. So that scene that Walter describes is not uncommon. It's a common theme about racial terrorism and the sexual abuse of black women during this time period. Now, the most shocking example of racial terrorism in music history is clearly Walter's death. Frank returns from Mississippi to inform Etta of Walter's fate and to clean out his apartment. By this time, Etta's mind is made up. She's headed to Greenwood to be with the love of her life and to join SNCC. Frank says to her, quote, "He's gone. Walter's gone. He left the scene. Split. Finito. He was in a hurry to the car. I could see him. He opened the door. Then he turned on the ignition, the same way he always did. I was coming around the corner. Before I could get to the car, a bomb went off. You wouldn't recognize him now. Not now." The final scene of this play is heart-rending. This play can be read as a tragedy of some sort. Walter's suffering and death and the grieving of those closest to him probably impacts Seton's readers and audience. One wonders what he could have accomplished. Perhaps he would have transformed into another Stokely Carmichael. Instead, he joins the river of black men who have been murdered in the United States since the nation's founding. Walter's death is perhaps most eloquently captured by W.E.B. Du Bois, who in 1903, in his opus, The Souls of Black Folk, muses the following, quote, "Throughout history, the powers of single black men flash here and there, like falling stars, and die sometimes before the world has rightly gouged their brightness," end quote. Walter's a martyr, one who is not afraid to die for the cause. In his own words, quote, "It's not about me. It's not about what I want personally," end quote. The end of the play leaves many questions unanswered, prompting me personally to think about what Etta decides to do with her life. Does she resolve to venture south to join the civil rights movement? Does she pursue music history and become a scholar activist? Does she rethink her decision to drop out of Pi Lambda? And how does she cope with the death of her mentor, intellectual sparring partner, and soulmate? Members of the millennial hip-hop generation, primarily those young African-Americans who have been socialized during the 21st century, can learn a great deal from reading and or viewing music history. Most importantly, with Etta, they can learn to know thyself and to follow their hearts in making monumental decisions in their lives, from selecting a major to tapping into one's inner voice to crafting an authentic identity. Through Walter, they can better appreciate the value of helping others, fighting for social change, and being willing to sacrifice for a higher cause. Such values are especially relevant for today's young African Americans, members of the multi-tiered and multi-generational hip-hop generation, who are all too often being socialized to be self-centered and disconnected from the African American historical experience. Young African-American adults, those coming of age, are the main characters in Seton's plays. They, as well as their counterparts in successive generations, have the potential to make history. Music history is therefore a useful dramatization of what the civil rights movement could have entailed for young black university students. What these experiences actually entailed, we will never know with any certitude, because we don't know what happened in the past for sure any time. However, as Seton demonstrates, we can use our imaginations to offer, in her words, quote, "a glimpse," end quote, of the black past. Thank you.
All right, good afternoon. And I'd like to thank Sandra, the playwright. And we just got acquainted in the last couple of days, Kevin, right? Although I had been told about this project in the months ago, and I looked at it and I was scared. I'm being truthful. But Kevin came to my office and sat with me and held my hand and showed me how it worked and put up some things. Brian. And so I started to see like the wonderful possibilities and handed him my syllabus for another class. And we talked about how this technology might be used. And so I'm excited about the future and actually putting some other materials up for other classes I'm doing. So I thank you, Brian, and I thank you, Sandra, for pushing me to not be so scared of technology. My paper complements, hopefully, and Perel's paper, it gives us a connection, because he leaves with talking about the coming of age. And this paper talks specifically about Etta's coming of age. And I look at this play as a coming-of-age narrative. The original American coming-of-age narratives parallel the myth of United States becoming a nation. R.W.C. Lewis's concept of the American Adam story playing out in the American West, an innocent pastoral land, is a prototypical narrative theme of early American coming of age stories. American writers have portrayed the new nation as rebellious, adolescent, establishing its identity in contrast to the tainted European old world. In 20th century, the coming of age and narratives have shifted, and the journey of the rugged individual moving into adulthood came to be mean a coming of age, coming to terms with one's place in American history. The African-American coming of age narratives rupture the conventional white American tale of U.S. innocence with the introduction of race, slave history, and racism. In the American African-American coming of age narrative, it's American racism that propels the protagonist from adolescence into an all too often abrupt state of maturity. Hence, the modern American coming of age tales by writers of color, female writers and gay writers, are concerned with ethical challenges and in the context of the politics of self in contemporary America. Williams draws on Eleanor Traylor's concept of discourse altering to explore the strategies that African-American female writers employ in their work. Black female writers have adopted and adapted coming-of-age genre, such as the protagonists in their narrative striving for a coming-of-age and subsequent destruction of innocence through their relationships as part of an African-American community, not as individuals separated from civilization. African-American coming-of-age narratives function as a metaphor for the formation of Black subjectivity, Williams states. And I hold that the subjectivity of Black female protagonists is influenced and shaped not only by race, but gender, of course, but class as well. And that this is where Sandra's work is very helpful at helping us to understand that. Coming-of-age narratives serve to introduce the protagonist to the reality of being female in a white, racist, capitalistic society where Black female sexuality is often commodified and under threat. Black female writers offer a vantage point for understanding neglected and misrepresented stories, but more importantly, they illustrate through their stories how Black women define themselves and find agency between mirrors of Black and white, male, female, wealth, and poverty. Sandra Seton's play builds on and contributes to the tradition of Black female produced coming-of-age stories set in the civil rights era, such as Alice Walker's novel Meridian and Anne Moody's novel Coming of Age in Mississippi. These stories address and illuminate the double discrimination that Black women faced and continue to face in America. Walker's Meridian is an interesting parallel to Sandra's play. The protagonist here comes from a humble background, and she is also struggling to realize herself in a world that has very narrow and distorted definitions for Black women. As a student at Saxton College, which is stands in for Spelman College, she hones and practices her budding political position, which is diametrically opposed to that of the conservative college officials and faculty who seek to develop refined middle-class Negro women. In Moody's tale, it's autobiographical. She also comes from a poor Southern background like Meridian and attends HBCUs, Natchez College and Tougaloo College. And then again, is at college that Anne's political and feminist views begin to blossom. And by the time, for a time, she is committed to the movement, but in the end, she becomes completely disillusioned. And we think that it indicates that she leaves the movement. Sandra's narrative of music history takes another path. And it was set on the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign's campus. So now set in the North, Etta Bradshaw is the daughter of an upwardly mobile Tennessee family that has settled on the Chicago's West Side. The Etta character is a music education major, and as we saw, is it a Pi Lambda initiate. Her love interest, Walter, we know is a graduate student and member of the Kappa fraternity. and also a member is a volunteer, or excuse me, activist in the SNCC. And he's been regularly traveling south to do civil rights work. As Etta starts to explore and experiment with other ways of being, she challenges her sorority initiates' narrow definitions of black identity. And at the same time, Walter is defining American racial politics for Etta through his tales of civil rights work. And in the end, it is Walter's commitment to the movement and eventual murder that catapults Etta into adulthood and challenges her move towards a future that is clearly informed by her collective past. I'm going to move ahead a little bit. So what I did in my paper was talk about Etta's coming of age in a way that where she in four parts of her life. Etta is defined by others around her. She's defined by her sorority sisters, but she is denying these other definitions that people are trying to put on Etta. Etta's sorority sister, Feezy, insists that Etta has outgrown her. Etta's heavy. She's got big plans, ideas, and they don't include me. While Monica claims that Etta is denying her race. I saw you at the music building Friday night, partying with all those grays, acting white. Yet Etta's third sorority sister, Shirley, thinks she's just plain strange. Etta, she likes weird, unusual things, stuff you never heard of. And to people outside of her sorority house, Etta's love interest, he sees her as having characteristics like his headstrong mother. From the first day we met, you knew where you were going. You knew you were headed. You were on a mission. His friend Frank thinks that Etta is just flighty and uppity. Miss Sadidi can't even say hello. Oops, out of space, calling out of space. And finally, for white students on campus, Etta is a spokesperson for the race. Etta recounts to Walter, as we saw in the excerpt that was performed, the incident where a white girl asked her, what do you think about integration? And Etta's incensed, and she says to Walter, can you believe that? Everywhere I go, that's all they ask me. You know, that stuff about Mississippi. She resists these many ways that others define her. The rites of passage that Etta experiences cross all realms of her life, cultural, social, sexual, and political. By going through these rites, Etta fully completes her initiation from girlhood into black womanhood. Seton employs Etta's social initiation to explore issues of social class and distinctive role class plays in the coming of age journey of Etta. Etta's social initiation to black middle class is signified by her affiliation with these two exclusive African American institutions, the Pi Lambdas and the Cotillion. The Pi Lambdas, we see some images here, the African American sorority that Etta aspires to join, and the Cotillion, a coming out ceremony that Etta and her fellow classmates had likely participated in high school, are strong markers of social mobility in African American life. The Pi Lambdas are, a thinly veiled version of the AKAs sorority, and one of the most elite black sorority, the oldest black sorority. In association with this group of educated and refined women, like Etta's mother and her aunt and others, would assure Etta access to a successful career and a network of beneficial relationships and a full social life, black social life. While the Cotillion, a tradition adopted from white elite by black upper crust Southern society just after emancipation, served as a rite of passage ceremony where young women were formally presented to black society. Again, Etta's participation in the Cotillion could smooth her passage into adulthood as a member of black middle class. These formal established and exclusive rites of passage squarely align with the middle class aspirations and values that Etta and her classmates. However, Etta begins to question and even reject her prescribed social initiation. The second rite of passage I'll talk about is the cultural initiation. and this this initiation into white cultural world. This is the world that Etta is determined to understand, and so that she can straddle her two ways of being, or many ways of being, and benefit from all the world that all the world has to offer her. Etta's innocence will not allow her to recognize any boundaries. Set on understanding this new world, Etta adopts the dress of the avant-garde and takes in jazz, blues, and experimental music scenes. Etta yearns the carefree experimental lifestyle of her fellow white classmates, so much so that Monica, as I said earlier, accuses her of studying white folks. Etta literally tries on white identities through her change in dress. Etta begins to wear the style of the clothes of beatniks, all black, and they look as if they stepped off the pages of Elle magazine instead of the pages of Ebony magazine. So these two magazines are featured prominently in the play. Etta declares that with her clothes, she's merely expressing her new experimental self. When her sorority sisters tell her that she'll get punished for wearing slacks, Etta snaps, "This place is driving me crazy." Aware of the expectations as a black woman in a racial social uplift program, Etta feels pinned in. Another area where initiation is sexual initiation. The strict moral code for young black women in the 60s and the great concern with protecting and restoring black female sexuality is firmly rooted in U.S. history of slavery, Jim Crow, and institutionalized racism. And for hundreds of years, black women suffered under the threat of sexual violence. Hence, the prescribed moral code represents one response that black people had to this violence. Specifically, African American society dictated that single black women be modest and virtuous. The institutions and practices such as black women's social clubs, solely devoted to the project of protecting and restoring black female sexuality, were very much tied to middle class status. Etta's sexual initiation puts her in direct opposition to this moral code. Her sexual initiation causes a rupture in her relationship with her mother, her sorority sisters, and the greater African American society's expectations of her chastity. Initially, Etta is unprepared to reveal to her mother and that she's broken this code. And when Etta talks to her mother on the phone after leaving the sorority house, she lies and tells her mother she's staying at the YWCA, she's going to stay at the Y. When Etta finally embraces her adulthood and her feelings, she is able to be truthful with her mother in the end of the play and in all aspects of her life, including her desire and plans to serve as a civil rights worker. Etta's rupture in the sexual moral code somehow frees her to break others' expectations and definitions, and it ultimately prepares her for her political initiation. So that final initiation is in the political realm. Etta's transition through this rite prepares her to fully enter adulthood. She accepts this new stage as an active participant in the civil rights movement, a change agent in the struggle for racial equality and authentic freedom. Numerous times through music history, Etta refuses to acknowledge the racial boundaries others accept and operate within. She operates as an innocent woman, ignorant of this past, history of racism and its legacy. Funny. Etta experiences several experiences or has conversations that kind of moves her closer and closer to this this awakening. And she becomes first exposed to the racist political workings of Jim Crow South while listening to the firsthand accounts of SNCC workers Walter and Frank. They recounted both the tremendous fear and bravery of the black Southerners living under American apartheid. And it's Walter's story of a woman forced to answer impossible questions on a voter registration test that particularly impacts Etta. And we heard that done earlier. And this is an example of some questions that would have been on one of those literacy tests. I especially liked, I think it was number 5, circle the first comma, first letter of the alphabet in this line. So they were just nonsensical and impossible tests that blacks had to take. Etta's youthful innocence allows her to imagine a life, and she talks about it, allows her to imagine a life free from racism, a freedom that she sees in John Cage. However, as Etta's memories resurface, she knows that freedom is not yet for everyone. And she talks about that the memory of seeing her mom seeing this picture of the kid eating the watermelon, her mother's refusal to eat watermelon after that. And as said earlier, Walter's death is really the final rite that helps Etta to transition into adulthood. She's just, you know, decided to go to Mississippi. She tells her sorority sister, she tells her mother. Etta has resolved to join the movement and the SNCC family. She is no longer fighting this all on her own, as she says. When Frank tells Etta that Walter has been killed, Etta lapses into a memory of a conversation that she had with Walter. She picks up her suitcase and she's off to her chosen destiny. Throughout the play, Etta is attempting to define herself and exert her independence, so much so that Walter calls her Miss Opposite. For Etta, independence means freedom from what others have prescribed for her. Etta equates her declaration of independence with adulthood. Her expression of independence can be seen in a series of decisions she makes, changing her major, leaving the sorority, moving in with Walter, and sleeping with Walter. However, it is not until Etta makes her final decision, that is, to go south and join the civil rights movement, that Etta truly crosses over into adulthood. This decision is not made for selfish reasons, but out of a new sense of collective responsibility and purpose. In the end, the coming-of-age tale of Etta Bradshaw is a metaphor for coming-of-age of the history of the civil rights movement. Sandra Seddon offers a vehicle for looking back through 21st century eyes that know how the future unfolded. Etta provides a prototype for blacks living in the postmodern world who are able to negotiate many identities, appropriating those things that give meaning to modern experience and engage in a struggle to free all oppressed people. Thank you.